mechanical rotating device. Now I think it's done all electronically to be more reliable. But in the case of a VOR station, the center antenna is transmitting a reference signal that is FM modulated. The 12 or so antennas placed around that center antenna are getting a signal that changes in amplitude and phase in a characteristic manner. And so that what your VOR receiver does is it looks at the FM modulated signal, it looks at the AM modulated signal, compares the two, it compares the phase angle between these two sinusoidal modulations, and it says, hey, there's 90 degrees of phase difference. That means I'm east, I'm dead east of that VOR station. If there's 180 degrees of difference, I'm dead south. If there's 270 degrees of difference, I'm dead west, and so on. If there's 0 degrees of phase difference, I'm north. So a goniometer is the next step above a variometer, and there's a close relationship between the two. Over to you, Charlie, the V2EGT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KEY, that comment.
I'm standing with you with the comment.
Okay, Mel and Charlie right after, I mean Mel and Wesley right after Charlie. Go ahead, Charlie.
This is WA2EGT. Dick, you never fail to amaze me how you can grab onto something and run with it. And I mean that in a very positive way. Did you want something else? But this brings me back to a question of just exactly what Wesley has, because I haven't gone off the line to look at it. And Wesley, I will look at it. At first, I got the impression that that the primary was in series with the secondary, or was it just a straight transformer, an independent primary, independent secondary? You're taking a network analyzer, putting a source on the primary, and the receiver port to the secondary, and you go into this rotation. Or do you have a series arrangement, primary and secondary series, and you're using that as your device under test and driving it at one side and putting the receiver on the other side and watching the response that way? I appreciate it, but just that clarification. And again, Dick, thank you very much, and thank you very much to the TechNet, and I will definitely endeavor to check in again. It's WA2EGT. Well, we get 2 TTTs.
And Gordon is third in line. He's got two independent coils. One is outside of the other. They're both, when he's set at 0 degrees, they are thoroughly parallel to each other. Let's say the outer coil.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
I'm going to say that the outer coil is 3 inches in diameter, the inner coil is 2.5 inches in diameter, and when he's set at 0 degrees, they are both completely parallel to each other. I am guessing he is feeding a signal into the outer coil between it and ground, and he is sensing the signal from the inner coil between it and ground for its two leads. So he's not using them in series. He's using them as two independent devices. One is the input and one is the output. And then he rotates and looks at the response on his vector network impedance analyzer. Mel, K2KEY, wait 4 seconds and you got it. And I guess we should start signing off. K2KEY, K2RIW.
And that's what I was about to say, but I was going to say a few words. You were mentioning link coupling. You know, most people associate link coupling as the RF power amplifier, but actually link coupling came about because in the 1930s, anything over 7 megahertz was considered already going up to the higher frequency. So at these higher frequencies, the advantage of reducing the effect of capacity on the LC ratio with use of separate tank coils. So what they did is they found that by using link coupling, in other words, you see the link coupling between the driver stage and the amplifier. And because the construction of those days, the driver circuit usually was separate from the amplifier circuit, there was a way of being able to connect the two together. You know, going from the driver, link coupling the driver tank, so-called coil, tank, the LC network of the driver system, to the input of the amplifier circuit coil by link coupling from one to the other. In other words, you have two link couplings. Over.
Yeah, you're bringing back a lot of memories. So a lot of link coupling occurred between individual stages of a receiver, a transmitter, the exciter section. Link coupling was very popular. And in the old days, the so-called IF cans that were in radios at 455 KC had a primary coil and a secondary coil, which is a kind of link coupling, a specific distance between the two, and the iron slugs that you ran in and out, depending on how you position the iron slugs, you could do tuning and some variation in coupling coefficient. So lots of circuits on both receivers and transmitters used various kinds of link coupling. Nowadays, with solid-state circuits, and we're not using tubes anymore, we don't seem to worry about capacitance anywhere near as much, and we want everything to be compact. Very few things are using link coupling these days. Everything is a direct capacitive, direct RLC coupling these days. And so, when's the last time I saw a transmitter with link coupling? I saw a 600-watt transmitter at 900 megacycles that used a kind of link coupling in the final stage, but it was done with toroids, so it doesn't look like link coupling. It looks like a transformer. It looks like a balancing-like device when you see the schematic diagram of it. So times have changed. Let's see now, Wesley and then Gordon in that order. Wesley, N2XJN, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN. Well, actually, a goniometer was using Schiffered X-ray diffraction equipment. So this kind of device is a very much precise one. But my question was, if you had a chance to look at my treasure, this the third video that I have, and it's the treasure for $10. I was able to pick up a number of very expensive devices, and actually I paid for them $10. There is the horn antenna with the connector on the end, and I believe it's a Schottky inside, a Schottky diode inside. And it goes to 10 gigahertz from, I believe, 7.1. And I described them on that video. And as a goniometer, there is a one device with the micrometric adjustment. And this device is a long one with in and out F connector on it. And it does have ability to regulate the attenuation from 250 megahertz up to 6,000 megahertz. Thank you.
Yes, I saw that video, and I got lots of comments on that, and I'll get to that in a little while. Gordon, go ahead.
Hi, Dick. Okay, so, you know, you were describing that, VOR technique for determining position by looking at the different phase differences between the two signals. And, you know, what a great example. I mean, that's almost the kind of practical hands-on example that should be used to introduce electrical engineering students as to why they should pay attention to, you know, their math and their circuit design courses. You know, because when they take AC circuits one, I mean, what a great simple thing that would help, you know, students kind of grasp what's going on. You can present each modulation method real quickly, and then you could go right to that, and it would support the mathematics would support it, and, you know, I know you and I have talked about the way we educate engineers is kind of bad backwards, I think. You lose the engineering talent before you get to the promised land, because you don't make it something they can wrap their brains around. But I think ETT said it too, that you know, you have a great way of making it very real. And I think that was a good example. Absolutely. You actually amazed me as well. So anyway, that would be good too. And I'm really looking forward to getting home and looking at Wesley's videos on coiled. Anyway, repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel. Sorry about that. I didn't leave it drop long enough.
Yeah, we lost the last 5 seconds, but I heard you on the input. And Mel, we got another satisfied customer there. That's what it sounds like. We got to send him a bill. You're absolutely right that when you're teaching an electrical engineering student how transmitters and receivers work, to go into a not too deep description of a VOR station, an FAA VOR station, VHF omnidirectional ranging station, is a beautiful demonstration of what phase shift is like. The majority of engineers walk out of the school not understanding what RF phase shift means. If one signal is a sine wave and the second signal is a sine wave on the exact same frequency, and one is 90 degrees shifted compared to the other, an awful high percentage of students really, that's just a bunch of words that has never been explained in a way that made sense to them, and they walk out of there with those words jumbling around in their head and not making any real meaning. Mel, I think you wanted to say something, and this was TechNet number 1313. This is number 1313 of the series that began in September of 1982. That's almost exactly 28 years ago. This could be our 28th anniversary, Mel. What do you think? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, I was just going to say goodnight to all the series. Shut the repeater down. And, yeah, Link coupling. Of course, I won't start in anything about another coupling that we knew back in our days called a gimmick coupling. A gimmick coupling, that's a good one to ask some of your friends to test to see if they have past knowledge in this industry. Ask them if they know what a gimmick coupling is. All right, with that, I'm going to say 73 to everybody. And for those who observe the Jewish holiday, Happy New Year. It's Rosh Hashanah coming up this week, and we'll look forward to doing it again next week. Thank you, 73. It's been great as always. Back to you, Dick, for any final.
Very fine, Mel. And yes, the gimmick coupling. Boy, I've used that a lot way back in the dark ages. Take two little pieces of wire and twist them together. And by changing the amount of length of the twist and the tightness of the twist, you're making a poor man's beautiful high Q variable capacitor in which you can adjust the coupling between stage A and stage B. And by adjusting that coupling and or tuning with that gimmick capacitor or a series of gimmick capacitors, you should see what I use for gimmick capacitors now, Mel, every single day of my life for the last few years. I'm building UHF antennas out of copper foil, and by taking little bitty strips of copper foil and laying them on top of each other with a piece of scotch tape in between, and by changing the amount of overlap with a long little stick, I'm making all kinds of variable capacitors. The modern day gimmick variable capacitor mill is made out of copper foil, copper tape foil, in strips that are about less than an eighth inch wide, maybe 3/8 of an inch long, between point A and point B, and as I said, with scotch tape in between, and by changing the amount of overlap, you change the amount of capacitance. You can make a lumped capacitor or a distributed capacitor out of that. You get two different effects. And one of the things that's not well known is these copper tapes that you use for doing shielding. The glue on most of those copper tapes is not conductive. So you put one piece of copper tape on top of another, and if you've got a whole lot of overlapping area and a lot of capacitance, yes, they act like one sheet. But if there's only a small amount of overlap, you better solder those edges Otherwise, those are two separate pieces of copper. I wonder if you've ever worked with copper tape, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the second half.
E2CTT also can adjust it with an exacto knife.
You sure can. Go ahead, Mel.
Yes, I've done some work with just actually using pre-TC board, you know, for capacitance. Actually, just using piece of PC board. But, you know, I was just saying that the old kind of, can you imagine today trying to get, like, for instance, if you wanted to wind the coils, we were talking about giving coupling and all. If, what happens if you wanted to get obtain something like list wire today, Dick? Do you think it'd be still available over?
Yes, it is still available, Mel. Litz wire does exist. I'll admit the number of places making it and selling it are very, very few, but it still exists. And for frequencies up to, I'm going to pick a number, 30 megacycles or so, it's a very valuable way of winding certain kinds of inductors and chokes and whatever, where the net result is a whole lot of very fine wires all held in a bundle, insulated from each other with a cotton insulation in some cases, or a form bar, or the combination of the two. And so now, the individual wires in the bundle give you very little eddy current, but the number of wires gives you very high copper areas. You end up with a very low resistance with very little eddy current to high frequencies. So Litz wire is a very valuable material. And I'll bet you less than 3% of the engineers coming out of a good school today know what Litz wire is. What do you think, Mel?
Well, I'm sure of it. I bet you showed it to, took a peek. I didn't realize. You mean it's somebody actually manufacturing it? Does he sell a foot of it a year? A roll of it a year, I doubt it. I really was quite surprised when you said you know of a company still manufacturing it. Take a piece of it and show it to your engineers, friends. And to say, what is this stuff?
I don't think it's 3%. I'd be doubtful it was 0.5%.
When did you first learn about Litz wire, Greg Gordon?
Maybe 7th or 8th grade.
During those boring classes while you were reading magazines behind a textbook?
Well, if you remember that QST and all the electronics magazines were smaller format, and therefore they sit outside various typical academic textbooks of the time. But no, I spent all of 7th grade and the first half of 8th grade in Shreveport, Louisiana at Southfield School, which is a private school down there. So we lived there for a year and a half. So I moved from New Jersey to Louisiana and then to New York City to Manhattan, where I went to the aforementioned St. Ignatius Loyola and Xavier High School, which was very cool. I liked Xavier a lot. But anyway, the bottom line is that, it probably was, reading, maybe something tomorrow, or maybe even something that was even more arcane. Maybe, I have to go look, but something out of one of the electronic journals of the time, and I'm just trying to think. I'm wondering if it was Ham Radio Magazine, or even 73, somebody had an article that mentioned the use of it, the fascination there, too.
36DPZ with a comment. Delta Papa Zulu, go ahead.
My language, English would be okay for this. Litz wire is also used on the armature and relays. That's also used in a lot of your earlier headphones. The cords on headphones is extremely flexible. Now, English pronunciation proper, K6DPZ.
Not quite good that time. I had some fun with him, the way he pronounced the balloning device last week. Now, Wesley, when it comes to your movie with reference to those $10 items you brought, you've got some very nice ones there. You may or may not know that feed horn, let me drop. That feed horn is a standard gain horn. It's used for antenna range reference measurements. You find the right, Nodder is one of the main brand names, but there's a number of brand names of building that exact horn. It's got an exponential taper, runs from something like 7 to 10 gigs. The waveguide that goes to it is WR110. That means that the waveguide has a major dimension of 1.1 inches. That's what the WR110 stands for. WR stands for waveguide rectangular, and the 110 is the number of 0.01 inches of the major dimension. And so the thing on the back of it, which we think is a step recovery diode, maybe a harmonic generator, but the thing on the back of it that would look somewhat like what that could be a waveguide to coax adapter. That's the way the horn is often used. And that horn is a standard gain horn of approximately 15.5 decibels of gain with a very slight predictable slant in that gain across that frequency region. So that's a very nice horn. You can use that for all kinds of sniffing operations. The horn, regardless of what it says on the side, really has a cutoff frequency of around 5 or so, 5.5 gigahertz, and it goes up to light, if you know what I mean, with a somewhat predictable performance all the way. Very similar to directional couplers. You can use them way beyond their frequency region down low. Well, things with waveguide you can use a little bit lower than the rated frequency and a whole lot higher. Let me drop. Your device that's got the micrometric on it, when you take that apart and look inside, you'll find out that it is a kind of directional coupler, where there is, between the input connector and the output connector, a so-called straight-through tri-plate strip line. And the micrometer dial is operating a worm drive, which is taking the coupling piece of strip line, which lies parallel to the main strip line, the straight-through strip line, and moving it closer and further away, changing the coupling coefficient. So that is a variable coupling coefficient directional coupler, is what that is. Your red and blue device, what looks like it's made by Nodder, that has the type N connectors on it, and I think that ran at a slightly lower frequency, yes, that is the kind of coaxial type strip line directional coupler that I was discussing last week, and with a predictable amount of coupling, like maybe that starts off at either 10 or 20 dB of coupling coefficient, and as you go down in frequency from its rated center frequency, that formula I gave you last week will allow you to predict the extra amount of coupling coefficient it has all the way down to 10 kilohertz if you want to use it there. And maybe at 10 kilohertz it's a 100 decibel directional coupler, coupling coefficient of 100 dB down. But very predictable, and that's one of the things I was discussing. I'm trying to remember the other things you had in that picture. The red and blue coupler, the purely blue coupler with the micrometer dial, the horn with the what looked like waveguide coax adapter, but maybe it's a step recovery diode harmonic generator, and that would be a comb generator. Feed the right kind of signal into that, and it'll generate comb lines all across that microwave frequency. That would be very handy for doing certain kinds of antenna measurements. Over to you, Wesley, N2XJN. Wait for a few seconds. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN. Thank you, Jake, for commenting on that. Well, one that is for immediate use is the VHF attenuator that goes from DC to 500 MHz. That's the one with one PNC connector a little bit bended. And it has also dial on it, so I can switch to 12 position. Actually, even more, even 13 position, no, 12 position. 12 positions. And one that has a, I couldn't quite understand. There is a Grumman Aircraft Engineer Corporation that is up. And this was made by Narda Microline Attenuator Model 792FM. It does have in and out, but it does have a two descriptions on it. One it says 2.0 to 2.5 gigahertz at 0 to 7 dB minimum, And then, right below, there is another line, which says 2.5 to 12.4 gigahertz with 0 to 20 dB is minimum. And there is a nice dial with dual dial with a small curved window on it. Back to you.
Yeah, to my knowledge, that is a directional coupler or variable attenuator. I'm not quite sure which. But as you operate that multi-turn dial, which has an inner and outer set of numbers to it, it's giving you fine resolution, so you can always go back to the same setting. There probably is a calibration chart that you can get a hold of, by which the dial setting and the attenuation at each individual frequency would be defined by that chart. And that's made by the Microline company. The Grumman stamp you see is the calibration stamp of the company who owned it. They did not manufacture that. That's the calibration sticker and the sticker for the instrumentation department because they owned it. So that is Grumman surplus material that you bought, which was manufactured by the Microline company, I think. The Hewlett-Packard 355, I think it is, Delta, Echo, that's the step attenuators that are rated up to 500 megacycles, BNC connectors in and out, and repairing that BNC connector, that's something you can definitely handle. And the BNC connector doesn't have to be perfect to do the job. Those step attenuators come in two forms. One form comes in 10 decibel steps, 0 to 70 decibels. The other form comes in 1 decibel steps, 0 to 13 or 0 to 12, I'm not sure which. And so when it comes to fine attenuation settings in that frequency range of DC to 500 megacycles, that in its day, in the 1970 time frame, was a very respected step attenuator. You look inside of that thing, you'll find a bunch of cascaded attenuators with bypassing switches. There's about 4 or 5
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's about 4 or 5 cascaded attenuators with 4 or 5 bypassing switches around each one of them. So the first attenuator is a 1 dB step, the second one's a 2 dB step, the third one's a 4 dB step, and the fourth one is an 8 dB step. I think it works in a binary manner. And don't exceed more than 1 watt of input, otherwise you burn up the attenuator. 1 or 2 watts, something like that it's rated for. And in its day, 0 to 500 megacycles was a very wide frequency range. The modern day equivalent of that has a different connector other than BNC, usually SMA connector, and they go either 0 to 12 or 0 to 18 gigahertz is the modern day equivalent. And they're built quite a bit smaller. But in its day, that was a very respected step attenuator. And as I said, you'll be able to repair that bent up BNC connector. That connector is bent up because somebody dropped it on the floor and it landed on that connector. And even if you can't bend it back, there's a way you can buy that particular connector, take it apart, and reinstall the new one. I didn't say that's easy. You're a lot better off to use a good set of needle nose pliers and carefully bend that connector back. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, thank you, Dick and Rick and Fergie. Yeah, thank you very much for all of this information. The question that I have is the one that has a micrometric dial, which is rated from 250 megahertz to 6,000 megahertz, and you say that it says variable attenuator on it, and you say that this is actually very precise directional coupler. Question then, would that go to 2 meter bend as well if it's rated for 250 at the minimum? But do you...
Yes, it will definitely go to lower frequencies. But at the lower frequencies, the manufacturer is not guaranteeing the calibration. But with all the instrumentation you have in your laboratory, you can measure what is the insertion loss at every frequency you care about for every particular dial setting. You can come up with a brand new calibration curve that goes all the way down to your frequencies. It will, in general, have more attenuation, at lower frequencies. But it will be repeatable. And I think it is likely to have very good standing wave ratio at lower frequencies. It's just not rated for the use down there. And it will have a slant to its operation. See, across its rated frequency regions, it is reasonably flat across those two frequency regions that they mentioned. And when you use it at lower frequencies, it will have a different slant of frequency versus attenuation versus dial setting. But you can make yourself a chart, and I think there are times when you'll use it that way. Over to you, Wesley.
Well, you too, TTT. We talked about that with directional couplers last week or week before.
It, this thing is a little bit different than a directional coupler. I think it only has one input connector and one output connector. I'm not sure it's got a through line and a coupled line. I think it's intended as a variable attenuator, and the main through line is going into an internal termination, I think. Over to you, Wesley.
Comment. That is correct. Okay, comments, please.
Wesley, if that BNC connector has just been ablated, squashed, but not bent in, the best way to straighten that out is with the old flaring tool devices they have in the hardware store. Use the clamp section. It'll straighten it out perfectly, and I've done that several times.
Unfortunately, the outer dimension of the BNC connector was bent inward almost to the point of touching the center conductor. Over to you, John.
Okay, yeah, that's a difficult one. Okay, then the needle nose, the round type, if you have, will do. But I thought it was just ablated.
Yeah, I've had BNC connectors like that with roughly that amount of bending. And if you spend enough time with the right kind of flat and round needle nose pliers and do it slowly, you can make that as perfect as you like, Wesley. That's just a kind of a sheet metal bending job, if you know what I mean. It'll take some time.
Yeah, Dick, I'm becoming sentimental. I look at the dial, the micrometric dial on it, and it's brown and sharp. Kingstone, RL, United States of America. Can you believe this was the standard of the quality? And the groomman was buying this stuff. Back to you, until it's here.
I don't know how to straighten it out, Dick, the BNC.
Go ahead, Mel.
You look at a little socket set, you know, these little sets of sockets. They sell from very small, what do they get down to? They have metrics, you know, they sell these little sets of all size sockets. You find the one that just slips in the side for a BNC, and if you force it in, just tap it in very slowly, it'll straighten out the BNC. I've done it a number of times with one of those sockets. I don't remember which one I used. I guess it depends on the set, but it will give you the form right away, Dick. You'll find definitely either in the metric or in the regular set of the sockets which one just happens to fit right over.
That's a very good idea. So in other words, you choose the right one. It's the sockets for a socket wrench are a very hard, very round object. Choose the right one. Force it in. After you force it in, you do a little bit of tapping on the outside to reform the BNC connector a little bit further. Mel, go ahead.
Exactly. With a small mallet, you know, small hammer, just tap it around a little bit and reshape it. That will give you the support. I could say it's a hard, you know, socket's hard metal. It will give you a good solid something to make like an anvil, called the anvil effect, take over.
And I bet you Wesley already owns some metric-sized sockets that will be coming very close. So you're going to start off with a coarse amount of bending with needle nose, and then the fine structure you're going to be doing with this with the socket wrench, as I see it. Wesley, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Mel was surprised me quite a few times with his deep practical knowledge that he has. And I thank you very much for your advice. Definitely I'm going to do it this way. Mel?
After all these years spent in this business, Wesley, I think we picked up a lot of little ideas. I bet you Dick did the same thing that didn't come to his mind. So go ahead, Dick.
I'm sorry to say, I wasn't smart enough to use a socket. I did it. I bent up BNC connectors on a couple of occasions. Not quite as severe as Wesley's is bent up. And very carefully, I reformed it with needle-nose pliers. And it was good enough, although it was a little bit tight each time I did an insertion. So I didn't get it quite right. The socket wrench is a much better way. I'm going to remember that one. Learn something new every day, Mel. Okay.
One quick question before you go.
Go ahead.
Hey, how do you use, what benefit of using I can have of direction copper in frequency of 20 kilohertz? You know, I'm working with the high voltage. I don't necessarily have to put it on the side of the high voltage, but before the high voltage, I have a generator or set of generators, and I'm trying to maneuver with the frequency and the shape of the signal before I deliver it to the primary of the transformer, but with the separation of the FET, MOSFET transistor, but you.
One of the things you got to be a little bit slow on is impedance matching. When it comes to your signal generator that's feeding the primary of your Tesla coil, I don't know what impedance the Tesla coil is, but the chances are very high that it is quite far away from 50 ohms resistive. It's some other complicated impedance, and that impedance changes versus frequency. The square wave or the pulses that you're putting into your Tesla coil, you may be doing it at a 20 kilohertz rate, which means there's a primary component coming out of your signal generator of 20 kilohertz, but that is not a 20 kilohertz sine wave. Because it is a kind of a square wave or a pulse with sharp edges and a short rise time, a short fall time, and a short duration compared to the repetition frequency, that signal generator has a lot of higher frequency components. You've already got a clue about that. Let me drop. When you took the output of that signal generator through the right kind of an attenuator, and you put it into a spectrum analyzer, you saw a whole lot of other frequency components higher than 20 kilohertz. You probably saw 20, 60, 100.
Up to 1 gigahertz.
Doesn't surprise me. You saw all the odd harmonics. So that's the real frequency region coming out of your signal generator. That, in turn, with a directional coupler, will have various amounts of coupling coefficient. You could use the directional coupler as a way of sampling what the signal generator is supplying to the Tesla coil. For straight-through insertion loss of that nodder red and blue directional coupler at those low frequencies will have an insertion loss that's very close to zero. Almost no ohms, almost no insertion loss, and it will allow you to sample what frequencies you're putting in and what amplitude. There'll be a calibration curve for each one of those frequencies, but the directional coupler into a spectrum analyzer would allow you to sample what the signal generator is applying to the Tesla coil without really sucking away very much energy or without disturbing it. It's a coaxial connector in and out, and in that particular case, the fact that the Tesla coil is not a pure 50 ohm load, I don't think it's going to create much of a problem. But that can all be calibrated. So it is a way of sampling what you're putting in. A scope probe would also do it. and which is the best way to do it, I'm not sure. The nice thing about the directional coupler is that if the voltage you're putting in is very high, and the directional coupler at that particular frequency has 80 decibels of coupling coefficient, that's exactly what you want. You've got to cut down that signal that's very high before you apply it to your instrumentation. If you decide to someday feed pulses into your Tesla coil at the 1,000-volt range, and 80 decibels of coupling from there would bring the 1,000 volts down to millivolts, where it could go into your instrumentation. So I'm pretty sure there are ways you can...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I'm reasonably sure there are ways you can use it. And for each of the frequencies you're using it at, you can calibrate it. So that NADA red and blue directional coupler for that measurement could very well be the thing you're looking for. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW in the second hand.
Okay, Dick. So I have a three connectors. And on the left-hand side, I have the input. Then on the top, I have minus 10 dB. And the assumption is that on the right-hand side, I have the output. And on that scale that is over there, it says coupling dB. And it says 3.7 to 8.3, which vertically, it gives me probably 0, 9.5, 10, and 10.5. On the horizontal, it gives me 3.7 at the 0 point on the left-hand side, and then 8.3 on the right-hand side. Now, the funny thing with this is that the characteristic on this scale is not printed, it's just stamped. It's like somebody from the manufacturer used the pointer just to point 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 small nuts on it to show the graph. Back to you.
I've seen a whole lot of them like that. That is the way NADA did it for many, many years. That proves to you, in theory, that each individual directional coupler at each one of those frequencies was individually calibrated. So somebody literally took a small punch, positioned it over the right position of that graph, and hit it with a small hammer as he went to each one of those frequencies and measured the coupling coefficient. If you take the lowest frequency on that graph and the highest frequency and average them, that is the center frequency of the directional coupler. That's where the coupled line inside is a quarter wavelength long, 90 degrees long. Once you know that it's 90 degrees at that center frequency, and you go to lower frequencies, if you went to one-tenth the frequency, for instance, of that center, instead of it being 90 degrees long, it's 9 degrees long. You take the sine of 9 degrees, take the sine of 90 degrees, which is unity, divide one to the other, that is the voltage ratio of the added coupling that occurs at lower frequencies. And where it's a 10 dB coupler approximately at the center frequency, you go through that, take the sine number and take the log of it and multiply by 20 to convert it to decibels. If that was, for instance, 20 more decibels, that would mean that your 10 dB coupler at one-tenth the frequency is approximately a 30 decibel couple. You'd add 20 to the 10. So the added number of decibels is 20 times the log of the new ratio compared to 90 degrees by taking the sines, if you know what I mean. It falls off in a sine function of amplitude in voltage.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It falls off as a sine in amplitude in voltage versus frequency as you go down in frequency. That's the way directional couplers work. So you can predict with pretty high accuracy just about exactly how many decibels of coupling it'll have, all the way down to as low a frequency as you want to go. Over to you, Wesley, and I got to leave you pretty soon. N2XJN, K2RIW in effect, man.
Okay, so my understanding is that at the input I'm connecting my, let's say, my generator, on the output I'm going further to the device, and on that side with that minus 10 dB, I'm connecting my oscilloscope or any other measurement tool with you.
Yes, you probably want to put a spectrum analyzer there, because since at lower frequencies the response falls off 6 decibels per octave, on a spectrum analyzer the individual components will make sense. Your oscilloscope will be combining each of those individual components with each of those individual coupling coefficients and coming up with a composite waveform, which will be a little bit more difficult to interpret. One other thing to concern about is that the straight-through line, the input and output connector, is a type N connector, and a type N connector can take the voltage equal to 20 kilowatts maximum before it arcs over. On a 50 ohm line, 20 kilowatts, you can calculate what voltage that is. And for very brief periods of time, that connector will take 20 kilowatts. You go beyond 20 kilowatts, you will arc over the connector. So the input type N connector has a voltage maximum that you don't want to exceed, otherwise it will arc to ground. It's not necessarily destructive, but you won't be getting the measurement you desire. Over to you, Wesley.
Well, actually, I'm operating with 5,000 volts, but right from the generator, it goes the generator, the square signal generator, it goes to the small board with the MOSFET on it, on the gate of the MOSFET. That's all. It's quite a few volts only. 10 volts, 15 volts, 20 volts maximum. Now, from the output of the MOSFET, I'm going on the primary winding of the flyback transformer, which is a few ohms. And then, on the secondary of the flyback, I have 5,000 volts, which one goes to the ground and the other one goes to the spark gap, whatever. Then, from the other side of the spark gap, I'm going to my thyroid ferrite pipe, where I have a transformer on it, which is the winded transformer by me. The primary consists from somewhere around 130 winds, and the secondary is whatever I put on it to play with it, usually no more than 10 to 20 winds. Back to you.
I just did the calculation for you. A type N connector on brief pulses cannot tolerate more than 1,000 volts. The instantaneous voltage that goes through the semiconductor to ground of a type N connector cannot exceed 1,000 volts, otherwise it might arc over. So as long as the instantaneous voltage you're putting through doesn't exceed 1,000 volts, that will do what you desire. Over to you, Wesley.
Thank you, Dick. Very valuable information. I mean, I spend the money on all of these devices, and they are not only devices for me, they are precious devices for me. I mean, I treat them very well, and I don't want to damage anything. And, one day, Dick, you got to visit my laboratory. I have so much stuff. Enter is here.
It sounds like you're treating all of your instruments with tender loving care. Sounds to me like you only speak to them in soft, soothing tones, and you only feed them cookies and milk. Sounds like you respect your instruments. Very good, Wesley. I've got to go. Bye-bye. Good luck. K2RIW clear. See you guys later.
Thank you, Mel, John, Eric, represent everybody and to exchange clear.
It all.
Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Mel. And everybody else on the net. Good night, Wesley. Talk to you tomorrow.
Talk to you tomorrow, my friend. And to exchange.
Law token at all. I do law token at 10 able. All token at him.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Circuit advisory and not necessarily for air. Ladies and gentlemen, with a report on Amateur Radio Newsline's financial status, here's our producer, Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF.
Well, the last time I was here with a financial report, I told you that I thought we might have enough in the bank to hold us over the months of July and August, basically the summer months. And I would not be asking for any contributions unless the sky was falling. Well, I'm happy to say the sky didn't fall, and I was able to keep that promise thanks to some frugal spending. And we made it through the summer months, those months. However, no matter how conservative one's spending is, there are still ongoing expenses that have to be met on a month-to-month basis. And as of now, we will find it hard to meet the bills for September when they begin arriving in 4 weeks. Well, actually, it's earlier than that because the bill for Verizon Wireless will be here around September 23rd, and that monster bill from Pacific Bell will be here on the 30th. And by early October, all the bills will be here, and we're going to need to be able to pay them. So this time, we're going to try something a little different. Instead of waiting for the sky to fall in, waiting for the last minute, we are asking our bulletin stations to spread the word that by the end of September, we need to raise between $900 and $1,000 so that we will be in a position to pay the September invoices when they arrive, and then raise $1,000 a month thereafter, which has been the case for years now. To be candid, I really do not like leaving off a newscast in an appeal such as this. But in reality, there is no other method of getting the word out to you that we need your financial assistance to keep Amateur Radio Newsline on the air. To all of us involved in Amateur Radio Newsline, each donation is looked upon as an ongoing vote of confidence, if you will, in the quality of the news and information that we provide each week. And for this, I'll add my personal thank you. And as we've said many times before, Amateur Radio Newsline is a 501c3 not-for-profit corporation, and that means your donations are tax-deductible. The easiest way to donate is by going to our website at www.arnewsline.org and clicking on the PayPal button you'll find at the top of the page. Or you can mail a donation to the address that you will hear at the end of this week's newscast. Whichever method you choose, the all-volunteer Amateur Radio Newsline team says thank you so much for caring, and we promise to continue to do all we can to bring you the news and information that you want to hear on your repeater or read on your computer each week. Thank you. I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, and now here's this week's Amateur Radio Newsline report.
Thank you, Bill. And now, Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1725, with a release date of Friday, September 3rd, 2010, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. A missing Arizona ham is found dead in a trailer, and an arrest is made. The following is a closed circuit advisory and not necessarily for air. Ladies and gentlemen, with a report on Amateur Radio Newsline's financial status, here's our producer, Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF.
Well, the last time I was here with a financial report, I told you that I thought we might have enough in the bank to hold us over the months of July and August, basically the summer months. And I would not be asking for any contributions unless the sky would fall. Well, I'm happy to say the sky didn't fall, and I was able to keep that promise thanks to some frugal spending. And we made it through the summer months, those months. However, no matter how conservative one's spending is, there are still ongoing expenses that have to be met on a month-to-month basis. And as of now, we will find it hard to meet the bills for September when they begin arriving in 4 weeks. Well, actually, earlier than that, because the bill for Verizon Wireless will be here around September 23rd, and that monster bill from Pacific Bell will be here on the 30th. And by early October, all the bills will be here, and we're going to need to be able to pay them. So this time, we're going to try something a little different. Instead of waiting for the sky to fall in, waiting for the last minute, we are asking our bulletin stations to spread the word that by the end of September, we need to raise between $900 and $1,000 so that we will be in a position to pay